This recording is a production of Faith Builders Resource Group. This recording was made at REACH 2017, held on March 23 and 24, 2017, in Lancaster, Pennsylvania.
It's working now? Good. Okay, thank you. Okay, well, you know what? I'm just going to juggle for about 5 seconds while you get comfortable and make noises and stuff over there. Yeah. This is wonderful. This is Pavlovian. You know, in order to learn to juggle, you have to learn to relax. Because if you're tense, you can't juggle. And so now that I know how, if I'm a little nervous looking at the thousand-eyed monster in front of me, I juggle, and just this amazing thing, I just sort of relax. And I feel better, and I can speak a little better, and it works out. It's a great technique. If you have to speak somewhere, learn to juggle. It's a wonderful thing. Again, thank you for being here, and we'll just make an invocation to God. God, please make the words of my mouth and the meditations of our hearts acceptable to you today. There's a traditional Jewish saying, and it asks, why were humans created? And of course, the answer is because God loves stories. Now, that may be changing a little bit, but typical Protestants and typical Anabaptists, they resist emotion. And so it tends to be just the mouth going here and words coming out in a nice, flat, even thing, you know, because you don't want to get too emotional because that's, you know, that can manipulate people and it can be dangerous. You can have somebody just take you right off a cliff with the lemmings or something. And it's a real concern. You know, even though that, you know, we can kind of laugh at it, it is right to be concerned about that. Like I said before, when you feel drawn into a story, put your hand on your wallet and hold it there, because that's what they're after. Yeah. But there is also an old adage. This is, again, drawing on Jewish rabbinical tradition. It says, a rabbi who cannot make his people weep or laugh is not worth his salt. And it's recognizing that we are not just flat words coming out. We're body and we're a soul and we have emotions. And we want to draw on all parts of us as we handle scripture, as we handle important words that we say to each other, as we live out life in community. So we want to recognize the dangers, but we don't want to, you know, somehow deny a third of our experience just because we could possibly make a mistake there. I want to point out that Jesus thought and taught in spoken word, in story. In the Gospels, farmers plant and they reap. Housewives sweep and they mix dough and they bake bread and they lose coins and have to go find them. Laborers gather grapes and they catch fish. And that's how the Gospel's presented to us. Jesus did not use Latin or Greek, as far as we know. He spoke in Aramaic. And Aramaic was the Pennsylvania Dutch of the day in that place. And there are still a few Christians in the world who still speak Aramaic, and they still pray Jesus' prayer, the Lord's Prayer, in the same sounds that he prayed it. It's a wonderful thing, and I'm so glad that still exists. So, I sat in a class or a breakout session an hour ago, and it was called "Why Not Just Let Wycliffe Do It?" or something like that. And it was an argument for why we should be involved in translating. And I have a little bit of story here to illustrate how I learned why Wycliffe even should exist, or any other organization like that, to translate the Bible. I mean, why can't people just learn English or Greek or whatever, Aramaic, I guess it would be. And it goes like this. Eli B. Helmuth holds the record 25 years for being on hospice in Reno County. 25 years. He died of multiple sclerosis. And it was a steady and incredibly slow death. I remember when I first came in 1984, he could kind of walk along the edge of the walls in his house. He couldn't go outside anymore. He was a farmer. That's all he ever wanted to do. And he spent 25 years in his house looking out the windows, wishing he could farm, and he couldn't. He creeped along the walls, and then they put railings so he could get along, and then the hospice people came in to get him out of bed and put him on a wheelchair. And then finally they had to just move him right onto the Lazy Boy, and that's where he spent his days, and then in his bed at night. And the church, you know, kind of tried to do things to help, and one of those things was the men's Sunday school classes would take turns going over to Eli B's house to have Sunday school, and we'd put our chairs up kind of around there, and we'd have our reading and our discussion, and he'd be lying here, and, you know, maybe he was listening and understanding, maybe not. We weren't sure always. And it just, you know, and he was going just millimeter by millimeter, he was going towards the end of his life. Well, this was just after I got back from university. And the people, my people, were not sure about me. But they did want to, you know, give me something to make me feel part of the church. That they assigned me a Sunday school class. And it was the Amen corner up in this corner of the church. And it was where all the oldest men went. That was it. They were old. I mean, creaky old. And I think the idea was, you know, they could see if I was fit to teach. And how hard would it be to, like, lead an old, old man astray? You know, and so that's where I was, and I was pleased. You know, I was all about teaching, and I really enjoyed it. I took it seriously and prepared, you know, and over prepared, I'm sure. And they were a great bunch of people. They helped me out a lot, and you know, they came prepared too. It was what I would wish for any one of you as a starting Sunday school teacher. And it was also about the time I got my first Pennsylvania Dutch version of the New Testament. Wycliffe had just come out with just the New Testament. They hadn't done the whole Bible. And I got a copy of that from one of my Amish bishop friends. He had a whole stack of them. And I thought this was going to be easy because this is my mother tongue, right? And I started, I know High German, I can read, and it was terrible. It was weird. Finally, I figured out if I sounded out the words out loud and listened to the sound of my voice, then it made sense. I could understand myself talking, but I had a hard time understanding my eyes reading that. And so with practice, I was able to do that. The other thing I noticed is my Sunday school class, everybody in there, their first language was Pennsylvania German. So I thought, hey, this is a good way to combine things and sort of, you know, perk it up a little bit. And so I started bringing that, you know, in. We would take turns reading verses, you know, around for part of the lesson, and then we would discuss. And I'd read my verse in Pennsylvania Dutch. And people thought it was kind of, you know, a curiosity at first, but I kept doing that. And then when it was our turn to go to Eli B's place to do Sunday school, you know, it was time to do the sower went forth to sow. And some fell on the rocks, and some fell on the thorn. That one? And it was springtime. It was the time when you should be teaching that one. We don't time things very much anymore, but it helps. So I worked on that. I read that three or four or five times, and I was ready, and we went, and we set up there, and Eli was here, you know, on his lazy boy, just kind of like this, you know, and kind of moaning, and, you know, we couldn't tell, but we were there just in case. And I remember he would interrupt us sometimes. Once he said, cornflakes for breakfast. And we kind of knew what was going on there. Another time he said, salt, that was quite a fire we had last night. And then somebody was like, well, when he was a boy, there was a horrible house fire back in Illinois. He remembers that now. So that was Eli. And there I was, and I was like, okay, class, so glad you're all here. And I started reading that scripture in Pennsylvania German, and I was totally focused, you know, getting the sounds right and the enunciation and the diction and working my way down there. And about, you know, I was reading the whole thing because I kind of wanted the whole experience for kind of for him. And about halfway down, I just like checking to see how he's doing over there, because he hadn't been wiggling around, not making any noises. And I looked over there, and he's just like right here beside me. And I saw streams of tears coming out of both eyes, going down his cheeks. And he was just holding as still as could be. And in his strange way, he was hearing his mother tongue. And it got through the multiple sclerosis and all those horrible things right into his heart. And that's when I learned why we translate into people's, they called it heart language, I call it mother tongue. So that's a little plug for that translating business. You know, go to his class now. I want to talk just, this is the kind of academic part of the program here. I have another little story, and then if we have time, and oh, there we go. You make sure I see the sign when it's 10 minutes, okay? Don't put it down till I acknowledge you. And then we're going to do a little story, and then we're going to have some question and answer. And so if you have questions, hang on to them and ask me, because I have a hard time knowing exactly where you're from and what you want to know. But I want to talk a little bit about the history of theological education. And I'm drawing on a little chart that, it'd be nice if you had this, but I don't plan ahead very far. That was done by Dr. Thomas E. Boomersheim from the United Theological Seminary in Dayton, Ohio. And I don't know much about him at all, but he has this little thing. And it basically, it describes the history of how people learned about God. And he starts out with oral. And he just says, this is the way Jesus did it. And then he has a couple of different things. It's manuscript, you know, when the Benedictine monks would write things out, and there were maybe 50 copies in the whole world of the Bible, possibly. Print, which is when, you know, you did it, but you didn't own, you had to be a wealthy person. And then now he calls it silent print, the 20th century. And that's what we want to look at. We want to look at the oral stage of the way that people learned about God, and then we want to look at what we call just the print stage that we have, in which everything that anybody ever wants to write is written. And so it's just about easier to just get the book and not listen to the person talk anymore. And then we want to think about what we have now, which is kind of coming away from that. We're glutted with writings, and there are people who just don't do that much anymore. They do things in text and in Skype, you know, that kind of stuff. And we call that the there's sort of a post-literate era in which we don't value print as much, because there's just too much of it and everything's on print and we can't wade through it anymore. So what I want to talk about is the internalization process that goes on. So you have Jesus telling and representing revelation. And the people who would be listening to that, for them, very important that they internalize that, because Jesus wasn't going to be with them anymore. And if they didn't understand it, have it in their heart, it was lost because they couldn't just go back and look at the notes, the handouts. He didn't have handouts. He would have had to go, like, kill a sheep and, you know, skin it and dry it. You know, all that's, it was just too much work. He didn't write everything down then. Well, now we move forward to the print era, you know, our era, or a little before it, when I was young. It's no longer important to internalize the words because they're all written out and we can have them in folders and in our drawers and in books on shelves and it, and we can just get that. We've outsourced our memory. And in some ways we've outsourced our heart. And we can just go over there to the library and get it out and we can read that and oh yeah, and then we put it away and the rest of the time that we don't have it, but it's okay, we can get it if we need it. That's kind of where it is now. And then if you think about after that, now that we're just flooded with all kinds of things and we don't really pay attention to anything so much anymore, and I'm not really talking about you, I'm talking about some imaginary other people outside there, because you are students and you do this. But now again, internalizing becomes very important. So if we want to, you know, influence somebody, we're not just going to depend on them to, you know, take the pile of handouts and read them when they get home. What I do with my handouts when I take them home, I put them on a stack by my bed. And then after a while, I move them under my bed. And then after a while, nothing else fits under there anymore. And then it's like, oh, I want to get that thing from the reach thing, and I can't find it. That's the way it works for me, and I probably not for anybody else here, but I'm just, it's confession time here now. Yeah, so let's just look at a little bit more. What would we describe the way of teaching? For Jesus, recitation might have been. So if I really wanted to know what he wanted me to know, I would listen very carefully, and I'd try to memorize it word for word maybe, and I would repeat it over and over again. If you're in the print stage of things, the important thing is you might go to a lecture, but you sure would get the book and you would read that. And now that we're overwhelmed, once again, it becomes somewhat more important to listen to people because for some mysterious reason, you know, if somebody, you know, waves their arms around and, you know, it puts some inflection in their voice, then it's kind of more fun than just kind of having the flat, you know, the lips going and the words coming out there. And so we're kind of rediscovering that the ancient roots there a little bit. So that's, I'm going to stop with that because there's too much lecturing going on here, and we want to do story. But it gives you an idea, you know, a little bit of a framework to think about how people have taught important things, how they've remembered them and repeated them, and the problems that are associated with all those things. So, I want to just point out, as we know from that first little story, that the sweetest sound on earth is our mother tongue. And I tell you, you know, Pennsylvania Dutch ain't much, but when I hear somebody speak that, I just come alive. And I want to find out, are they from Holmes County? Is that the accent? Or is it Lancaster or Northern Indiana? It's that kind of attention I pay to it. I just love that. And I can't help it. It's the sound that my mother gave to me when I was a little kid, and she had a beautiful voice. I mean, I think everybody's mother's voice is beautiful. And I think we want to recognize that and appreciate it and realize that we only get that once, and that's a precious thing. I'll say one more thing about storytelling, and that is that it is a way for us to deal with the most difficult things that life throws at us, because it helps us assign meaning, and when something means something to us, then we can somehow live with it. When it's broken and torn apart and we don't understand it, that's terrifying, absolutely terrifying. So I'm going to just tell you a little story, and it's a group of several stories, and I call it My Three Stages of Prayer. And we're going to start in 1965. I'm 4 years old, and you know, for me, God was somebody that you would say, oh, God, I want that silver pen light in the Farm and Fleet store. That's what I wanted. I remember just desiring that with my whole little four-year-old heart. Because you could turn that on and it wouldn't be scary at night. And you could go look for things, you know. It was going to solve all my problems. I thought, oh, I wanted that. It was gimme. That was my prayer. And I remember, you know, I wanted that so badly. And I remember I actually cried in the Farm and Fleet store. And my dad, who was, you know, you have to count your money and be careful, he relented and he bought it for me. And of course, it clicked on and it clicked off, and I ended up leaving it on, and the batteries were dead the next morning, and we didn't buy more batteries just on the whim, and so it wasn't all that satisfying. And the other thing is, my dad remembered, too, how it went with the cork pop gun that I'd gotten, you know? Like, I popped it about 100 times, and then I took it all apart to see where the pop was. And I couldn't put it back together again. And he remembered the train set, too. And he remembered that beautiful green bulldozer that Uncle Mervyn had given me. It was wonderful. It had rubber tracks. It had a key that you used to wind up the clockwork. And then you could set the lever for low with the blade, or medium, or high. And you'd turn that little lever on, and it would go, and it would push your toys across the floor. And smoke and sparks came out of the exhaust. It was just amazing. And I played with that solid for about 2 days, and then I noticed that, well, I wanted to see where the smokes and sparks were coming from. And I noticed that you could take the rubber tracks off, and there were little tabs that stuck out and bent over. And I got some tools out of my mom's sewing machine box, and I got those bent over, and I got parts, you know, to come off. And I was thinking I'd put it back together, so I was keeping it in order and everything. Yeah, I'm a budding mechanic here. And I finally got into the middle part, and it was like a beautiful clockworks with a spring in it, but I had to get that apart, too. Got it all apart, and suddenly just like a whole bunch of little gears were all over the place. I was going to get it, and I found the part that if you spun it, it made sparks and smoke, and I was so pleased. And I showed my mom, and she was, you know, it wasn't what she was expecting. I never got it back together again. But I'll give you parents who have children like that, I'll give you a little hope. I've learned to put stuff back together now. And I make a living at it. People bring me things. I take them apart. They pay me. And it still brings me satisfaction. So anyway, that's the gimme part. Now, move ahead a little bit. I'm 18 years old, and it's 1979 or so, and I'm out of the country for the very first time. I went with an old school bus and Sam Hostetler and his friends from Lynn, Missouri, and we wheeled all the way down to Guaymaca, Honduras, and we had adventures. It was a good thing I was a mechanic, or we might still be there going. But we got there, and it was just like an 18-year-old's adventure paradise. The termites had just gone and eaten the whole walls off of the church house, and they were falling off, so we changed the walls on the church house. It was a lot of fun. And there was volleyball and learning Spanish words, and you know, there were other young folks. There were girls my age that I had never seen before. It was so exciting. And we did a lot of stuff, but we noticed that Guaymaca was kind of in the middle of this long valley with these kind of mountains going up on each side. And there was this especially tall peak, kind of. You could see it sometimes when the clouds weren't there. It was always in the clouds, but once in a while you could see it. And they called it Mount Mosquito, I think. And I would look at that and I'd think, you know, that'd be quite a view from up there. And I got a bunch of boys interested, and we decided we're going to climb Mount Mosquito. People just didn't do that. They were busy making a living, but I led them up there somehow. We got up early. We took a little old Jeep somebody had. We drove as far as we could. We had machetes, and we started hacking through the vines and working our way up there. And, oh, by, you know, noon or so, we were at the kind of a promontory there, and we clearly weren't at the top yet. The mountain kept kind of saddling up higher, And the others were like, you know, we're going to have volleyball tonight. We don't want to miss that. We'd better head back. And I was like, I'm going to the top of this mountain. You know, I was kind of bullheaded at that time. And they said, okay. And I said, I don't think it'll take long. And I can really climb downhill fast, so I'll catch you. And so they took off, and I went that way, and it, you know, it kept going up, and then kind of down, and then kind of up, and down. And I just kept going, because I was going to go till I was sure I was on the top. And it was in the fog, so I couldn't really see very far. And there were orchids, and it was dripping, and it was kind of cloud forest, and it was beautiful and quiet. And, there, you know, I was looking for animals. There weren't any there. Anyway, finally, you know, I was like, okay, I'm probably kind of heading down again. I never was sure when I was at the very top. I thought, I'd better get back there because I want to play volleyball too. And so I was heading back and going up and down and up and down. I thought, you know, I could make better headway if I just went down the side of the mountain. And I knew there was a little creek down there, and I'd follow that creek and it'd go right down to Guaymaca, and I'd be there, you know, before 7. So I headed down. And, you know, it got dark. It was after 7, I guess. I don't know. I didn't have a wristwatch. And no cell phone. And I heard the creek. Yep, things were going to be good. Once I got there, I knew I could follow it even in the dark. And I got down to the creek, and lo and behold, it was flowing north. And my creek was supposed to flow south. I had gone way wrong. Totally wrong, and I was going to end up in San Pedro Sula or something if I went that way. I had this little moment of terror, and it was dark, you know, but I was like, okay, this is my plan. I'm turning around, and I'm heading up, and I was out of water. I had this little canteen, so I just filled it in the creek. You know, you could die of stomach bugs, or you could die of dehydration. I chose stomach bugs. And I headed back, and it got so dark that I finally could not go anymore. It was dangerous. There were cliffs that went way off. And I did not want to fall down there. They would never have found me. And so finally I decided, I have to stop. I have to stay the night on the backside of Mount Mosquito. And I was, you know, tough and 18 and everything, but I was a little scared, too. And I found this bio tree, we call them, with the big roots, and I kind of backed myself in between two big roots there, and I had my machete, and I stabbed it down in front of me. I was thinking about big tropical snakes for some reason, and it was not, like, settling at all. And I thought, well, they would at least ram their nose into that, the blade there, you know? And so I finally, I was distressed. I remember praying rather desperately, and my prayer went something like this. It was like, help me, God. That was that. That was the stage I'd gotten to finally. Well, I did sleep, and I don't remember what I dreamed about, but I woke up and the full moon was up and the clouds, the mist had kind of gone away, and I was able to, light of the moon, work my way on up. And by early the next forenoon, I'd gotten back over and was down, and I found a tractor. I found a tractor, and it was like, hey, no tractors up here. And then I listened, I heard way up in the distance little tiny voices going, and I yelled at them, but they wouldn't hear me, and I was not going to climb up there again, so I hotwired the tractor and made 3 honks and sat down and found a file and was working on the machete, and they had told, I didn't know this, but they said, if anybody finds him, honk the horn 3 times. So we were very glad to see each other, and they, me as well, and, you know, That was a wonderful time, but it was a stage in my prayer life there. Well, now we're going to go forward. We're going to go to 1993, and we're going to think a little bit about my sister, Regina. Now, you have to know that I am the oldest, and there are 4 brothers and 4 sisters after me. And with Rose and with Miriam and with David, we were just like pretty close together, and we were peers, and you fight with your peers when you're a little kid. And so it was just all about who could, you know, get whatever they wanted, and there wasn't enough usually. But when Regina came along, she was enough younger than me. She was 9 years younger, And I felt this kind of parental concern for her. And I took care of her. I carried her everywhere on the farm, and I called her Gina Babe. And she was my, no other kids better mess with Gina, because I was there to make sure that she was not harmed. And I remember about that summer, my mom contrived to, she thought the bull thistles were taking over, and she thought it'd be a great idea if I hoed them. And to encourage me to do that, I'd get a penny per bull thistle. And I remember I got 600 of those hoed out that summer. I guess that's $6. Oh boy, I was rich. And I remember when Christmas time came around, I was thinking, you know, I want to get something for Regina. And I went to Walsh's. And in the toy department, I found just the perfect thing. It was a green with black spots frog. And it had this yellow hose that came out of its back, and then it had a little squeeze thing here. And if you squeezed it, the frog would go, and it would jump up. And if you did it really hard, it would make little hops and go along. It was just the greatest frog ever. And that's what I got Regina. And we played with that thing until the hose came off. And even after that, we made it go, you know, even if it didn't want to. But that was Regina. And she had a sunny disposition, and she sang all the songs in the book before she did a whole lot of anything else. She loved singing, and she led a charmed life. She was just a wonderful person, is still, for that matter. Well, when she was 18, the boys noticed. Well, they noticed her before that, but she fell in love with Duane. And, you know, nobody was ever going to be good enough for Gina. You know how that is. Yeah, and I saw all his problems. You know, he had some warts on his hand. had hemophilia. You know, we knew about that because my dad has hemophilia. And he was like, well, you know, that's not great. But, you know, he could maybe make up for it by being a really super, you know, husband and everything. Well, they married. And not long after they married, he became sick. And when he went in to find out what was wrong, his doctor did blood tests, and he said, you know, we have some really terrible news for you. You're HIV positive, and you are developing AIDS. And you have to understand, back in 1990, when that happened, that was the most scary thing that you could imagine having happened to anybody you knew, because we didn't know anything about that. It was just this mysterious, horrible thing, and people just withered away, and then they got some infections, and they just kind of died in really disgusting ways. And it was terrifying. And it was frightening to the church and to the community as well. And, you know, if we were around him, we're probably all infected. And so, you know, you don't really understand what it's like to be a leper until you've got something that feels contagious and incurable and really disgusting. We had that. And Duane just simply, he went downhill. He died the 5th of September, 1992, 3 months after his daughter was born, Sarah. And that was it was a hard time for our family. It was a hard time for our community, our church. Well, we went on, you know, because you didn't really know, and Regina was healthy. I came back from university in the summer of 92, and I helped her put her farm together, because Duane had bought some sows, and they had 50 acres and a little tiny house and needed work, and I put fences in and, you know, spent my days with my sister and with her little baby and helped her, you know, get the little farrowing house ready for winter. And then I went back out to do my things in Kansas, but we'd come back. I'd come back as much as I could, and we'd spend time together because, you know, we loved each other, and, you know, life's a little uncertain, and the other thing was, it was our family more and not so much interaction with other people, because they were concerned. For good reasons, too, I suppose. Well, Regina and my mom did house cleaning jobs. That was one of the ways that, you know, they managed the finances and got the payments all made and did what needed to be done. And that went on for a few years. And then in the summer of 1995, Regina started getting sick. She was skinny as a rail finally by about September. I mean, you know, some people want to be skinny, but this wasn't what she wanted to be. And she was getting weak. She couldn't go do house cleaning things anymore. And I came back a lot more. And one of the things that my sisters and I and my mom love to do is play Scrabble. And we play for keeps. It's a big deal. Like my sister Rose still gets a little bit upset if I beat her, you know. And it makes it real that way. But we like doing that, and Regina as well. And so we play Scrabble. But it was different now. It was a little different because up to that point in our family, you know, really old people died who probably kind of wanted to anyway already. But young people did not die. We just didn't have to confront that. But here was Regina. She was 24 years old. And she was dying. But the good thing that brought to us is we started paying attention to what we were doing, to the little details. If we baked potatoes and had butter and salt on them, we thought about it and we were grateful. And we were so glad to speak to each other and just see that we're still alive. And if we played a Scrabble game, it was a big deal, and we wrote the score and the date and our names right on the board, right there. We have Scrabble boards that are just so full of those sorts of things you can barely see anything else. But that's what we did. We focused and we appreciated the little routines of our life. And we waited. What else can you do? That's what we're doing now. We're waiting and we're trying to appreciate. Well, Regina couldn't clean house anymore, so Mom went by herself, and Linda Walsworth said, "Where's Regina?" And she said, "Well, she's not doing so well." "Well, what's the deal?" And Mom kind of told her, because you don't talk about, you know, really disgusting, awful things in public so much. And she said, "This is not right. She needs to go see somebody." And Mom said, "Well, we've done that thing already, and nobody knows anything to do. I mean, there's ATZ, but that doesn't really even work." And she said, "That's nonsense. I know a specialist in Kansas City, and before my mom was done cleaning, she'd called and made an appointment and said, 'You're going out, yeah.' And you know, and so Mom was, 'Okay, we will. They went down to see her. My mom took Regina, and the guy said, the specialist, he said, "Well, this isn't for me to do, but I do know that Children's Mercy Lutheran Hospital over here, they have a unit that is really doing research, that you should go over there." So they went over there, and they immediately were able to see a doctor. There were like five women who were doctors, and they'd focused on AIDS. And they were treating mostly gay men. But there they were, and so they saw Regina and realized that she was in a dire place, and they said, "We can't do much for you. There's very little to do here, but there's this man, this researcher named Dr. Ho, and he believes that he understands the virus. And he has devised an experimental regimen, and he's been okayed by the Food and Drug people to do a small group study with his idea. And we're doing it here in Kansas City, and there is one more spot available. So if you want to join, you're welcome to do that. We don't know what will happen. It might not work. It might kill you. It might work." Well, what do we have to lose? Regina signed up. And so, you know, within a few weeks, she got started on that with a group of gay guys. You know, they go there. It was kind of an odd thing. There she was in her Mennonite, you know, covering and everything. And these gay guys, you know. And they'd run into each other all the time. And they became like, you know, they had that common ground. It was a strange thing. When you have something in common, you notice that maybe a little bit more than when you don't. But the amazing thing was, she got better. She started gaining weight again. She got her strength back. She thought, And she was probably right, that she was going to... She thought she was so close to dying that one day she came over to my mom and dad's house. Ha, we're not going to get into the Q&A, I'm sorry. Came to my mom and dad's house and said, look, I'm dying. We need to plan my funeral. And these are the songs that I want you to sing in this order. This is Sarah. Mom, you're going to have to take care of her. And now, here she's coming back, like from the dead for us. It was just an absolutely amazing thing. But the thing I want to leave with you is that experience, the wonderful thing that it taught us was the prayer that goes like this. It goes, thank you, thank you, thank you. And it's a prayer. That's the other thing I learned. Prayer isn't just a couple of words you say once in a while before you eat and, you know, before you do stuff. Prayer's an attitude. And it's an attitude that you wear and that people can feel and see. And it's the prayer I'd like all of you to be able to achieve. The prayer of thank you. This is such a wonderful world. These are such wonderful siblings. Such a wonderful church. What a wonderful mother tongue. It's just amazing. Thank you, God. That's what we want. And sometimes we suffer and there are hard things, but if we can get to that place, we are rich people. Thank you so much for coming here and listening to me. What do we have, a minute left? 2 minutes. 3 minutes. Oh, we are rich. We have 3 minutes. Here's what I'll do. I haven't spoken very much about technique. You can ask me any question you want to do with storytelling, and I'll try to answer it, or about my stories. And I know we're kind of jerking out of a different sort of emotional space here, but you're welcome to do that. Yes?
I know this may be what you're looking for, but just tell us where Regina is now and what she's doing.
Great question. Hosea wants to know, where's Regina and what is she doing now? That's really good. We need a postscript. Regina lives in Harrisburg, Oregon, and she remarried. She married Trevor Durstein, and Sarah complained ferociously, said, I want siblings. And so Trevor and Regina went to the adoption classes for a little bit, and then all of a sudden they got a call and said, we have 5 kids and we can't separate them. And the youngest one's in diapers and the oldest one's 10. And the mom, you know, she's off doing crack. And so, okay, they would take care of them. You know, you can't get just, bam, have 5 more children. But they fell in love with those children. And they are our nieces and nephews, and to celebrate the day that the judge pronounced them children and parents, I shaved my entire head. And when I got off the plane, my mom didn't recognize me.
Did you leave the beard?
Everything came off, just the eyebrows were left. I wanted everyone to know that an important thing had happened in my life. And I was pretty sure it would grow out again. So it's just wonderful to have, it's just wonderful to have Regina and to have, you know, they took on 2 more cousins and then there were twins that were born to the mom in prison. And that's 9, and now Regina said that's enough, she's tired, and somebody else is going to have to do the next bunch. And Sarah is married to Joel, and I guess all I can say is they're having a wonderful life. And I wish the same on you. Back to you.
This recording and many others are available from Christian Learning Resource, the campus bookstore at Faith Builders. For more information, call 1-814-789-4769 or visit us online at www.christianlearning.org.